One.
Kufar Akbar, everybody, welcome again to another edition of the Crossing the Crescent Discussion Group. This is a blog talk radio program dedicated to rightly dividing the truth between Christianity and Islam. We are here every Tuesday evening at 5 to 7 and Sunday afternoons from 2 to 4 Central Standard Time. And we are coming live from the cavernous depths of the Kafir Cave in Dar al-Harb, Kafiristan. I see we finally got Dragon in the chat. I was wondering what was going on. You're coming in late without any sound. Red's coming in time. He always comes in. Red always jumps in. He's early because he's late. You know what I'm saying. Normally late, but when he's early, or he's normally, I'm not even going to try that. I think what the problem is that when you take a day off, and you did a show. Did you do a show on BTR Sunday?
Yeah, I did. I didn't do BTR. I did. I just did the regular on YouTube.
You did. I didn't even see it. Is it on? Was it on my?
It's on my. It's on my. It's on your channel. I didn't ask for the code for you. So
That makes sense then because if you would have done it on my channel, I think it would have. It's okay. Yeah, we had a good time in Kafiristan East. We went to the Field of Dreams. Have you ever seen that movie Field of Dreams with Kevin Costner?
Yeah.
Back in the 90s, where he's a farmer in Iowa and he plows under his cornfield because he sees this vision, build it and they will come. So he builds a baseball field out in the middle of this cornfield. And it's still there. And so my wife's side of the family is a big ball. That's all we do is just play ball. Anyway, we went up there, and they actually had the ghost players there that day. They had people come. They had guys in uniform come out of the cornfield, and they put on this big. It was actually really cool. And I'm not a. I could care less about ball game unless my grandkids are playing. Of course, then I care. But I don't care about ball. Okay, so today we're going to continue to look at Mecca and the evidence for it. And I hope to not, I don't know if is this stuff boring to you guys?
It's of great interest. And I think that's, I advertise this show as apologetics because it talks about things that, today this is a topic that no Muslim will tell you. Why is that?
Well, you never know if you're losing your audience. That in this venue or using YouTube. I guess the only indicator is that how many people are currently viewing, and that fluctuates. Depending on the show. On Sundays, we always have twice as many people show up. But right now, if you go on YouTube, you will see that Avery over at God Logic is broadcasting. And so that's the big suck of everybody going over to Avery's show. Because and I'm not, and folks, I have no problem with you guys going over there, and you know, just come over here and watch us when you know, once you're done over there, because he is also a wealth of knowledge, and he does really good shows. I was, after I get done here, I always go over and watch him. And so, you know, he goes for 3-4 hours too. He's like a monster marathon runner. He can go for long periods of time, where this old guy, not so much. Okay, so let's go ahead and share the screen here. Yeah, I see that dragon. Yeah, I see that he is live. And I've actually, you know, what I've actually considered doing this show on a different date or a different time because of that. Because I on Sundays, nobody goes live on Sunday. Well, Sam Simone goes live every now and then on Sundays, but it's nothing consistent. But what, one thing that I always want to do is I want to be consistent with, you know, when I'm on and what days. That way you create this expectation that, hey, look, if I'm not doing anything, I can go over and watch, you know, the Caffer show over on the Cross and the Crescent. But at the same time, you don't want to make it so late. Because in BTR, what's the latest we can start on BTR, Paul? You know, is it?
At 10 o'clock and end at 12. So that's Usama's show.
But that's on the weekend.
Yeah.
I don't think the way that they got set up where we can do that during the week. I'll have to look.
I think as long as you start at 10, I think you're set. But yeah.
Before 10?
Yeah, you have to start at 10. We start at 9:50, but yeah.
Okay, I'll check it out. Next time I go to build a show, I'll look and see what's there. Okay. All right, so what have we been doing here the Mech and Mystery Part 4, believe it or not, Lost in the Desert. Where is Mecca? We've talked about here recently the problem with the sources. We've looked at it's when I say the sources, what I mean by that is that we have looked at the Quran. We've looked at the Hadith. We've looked at the Sira. We've looked at all these sources and realize that these sources are way too late. These sources are 9th and 10th century. So when they start talking about history, they're talking about history from 200 years prior without any connection to it. You have to have, and I get it. They're going to say, well, this is the what do they say? That's a train of the line of transmission or whatever. That we have all these transmitters, and we know that they all perfectly preserved whatever they were, the hadiths were. And then they try to sell you on the idea that you can trust that. And the fact of the matter is, you can't trust that. I mean, if you can't trust, this would be the equivalent of nobody talking about George Washington for 200 years, and then all of a sudden, poof, out comes this plethora of quotes, exact quotes and stories of this guy's life that you have to believe. And if you don't believe it, well, it's apostasy. You can be killed for it. So this would be the equivalent of it. So there's the problems with the sources. They're too late. They're too far away from biased people. Second thing is the trade routes. There are no, the trade route theory is all hoofta-toofta. It makes no sense to put goods, offload goods from a boat, put them on the back of pack animals, and then march up the side of a mountain. It makes no sense to do that. But yet that's what they ask you to believe. In lieu of just continuing to sail around, sail up the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aqaba. It makes no sense to try to trade that in that direction by offloading goods. And then we also realize that there's no archaeological evidence. And I think if there's any one death nail for the historicity of Islam, and if you could put a dagger in it and say, look, every religion has a history behind it. Every religion can define its history and demonstrate its history through archaeological evidence. Now, there are faith claims in it. That's true. for example, the resurrection of Christ. We don't have any, well, we actually do have physical evidence for the resurrection of Christ. We did a show on it or time or two called The Shroud of Turin. So we do have physical evidence for that, but let's just pretend we don't, okay? You still have archaeological evidence supporting the cities that exist that are named in the Bible. You still have archaeological evidence supporting the people like Sennacherib. We have his castle that demonstrate that these people are actually historical figures. Islam doesn't have that. There's nothing in Mecca, nothing from the 7th century. If there is, I dare you, I double dog dare you to bring it up in here and prove me a liar. Well, it just prove me wrong. It wouldn't prove me a liar because I have not seen any evidence of any archaeological evidence for the city of Mecca. And then on top of that, Paul put on, do Saudis dig around Mecca? Yeah, they've dug some pretty deep holes around the Kaaba. That's how you build those skyscrapers. So in order to build those skyscrapers, while you're digging up all that dirt to lay those foundations for those skyscrapers, you're going to find evidence for the existence of a city. If a city did exist prior to the 7th century, you would think that since it says there in the Quran that this is where Adam and Eve were thrown down to earth or ended up after they're thrown down to earth, you would have something from 6,000 years, the historicity of at least 6 to 10,000 years ago there, but they find nothing. That I would think, I would, if you have an honest intellectual bone in your body, that would at least set off some alarm bells. Say, wait a second. You know, because if we didn't have any, if we had no evidence, let's just make this an analogy. If we had no evidence for Jerusalem in the Bible, would you believe it? Would you believe the Bible at all? They said, oh, well, there's this Jerusalem. It sits right here. And you know, this is where Jesus died. And this is where all the Jews went to. And they celebrated this holiday and that holiday. And they made
there was no evidence that it actually, I mean, that would be, I mean, if it was just, we find out that Jerusalem was founded in 200 AD. Yeah. Something would be wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because we know it exists today.
To figure out. I mean, there's just so much. People forget that there are records. I mean, we actually have records as far back as BC where people have written documents and maps and a whole bunch of stuff. And you think it's hard to go back to 700 AD? 600 AD, we have maps from that far back.
Yeah, and guess what city's not on any of the maps?
Oh, exactly. Could that be that one that with that big M that people claim exists?
Right, exactly. There's no the map. So when we look at the archaeological evidence, the trade route, there's no, I think they have that in here, manuscript evidence. Let's see. Yeah, so there's no manuscript evidence indicating that people were, you know, that this city existed at the time. Okay. Then we've also looked at the documents from the era that pointed to Muhammad that say, oh, Muhammad said this, Muhammad did that. Well, last week we saw how fallacious a lot of these documents were, and how bogus they are. They have anachronisms on them that are clearly forgeries, redacting back on the history of Muhammad. And then we also looked at the Qiblas. I think that's a killer right there too.
I think the other thing that people, as much as if you haven't listened to this before, try and find Mecca in the Quran. Try and find it. I think there's a Becca.
Well, it's mentioned one time. It's mentioned one time. And we've had John Isaac on the show, Adam Seeker on the show, and people who speak Arabic and write Arabic. And they will tell you that in order to make the B and M, the only thing you have to do is put like a squiggly line on the end or the corner of the Arabic letter. And you could add that in. If you're copying the Quran or you're redacting something in it, you can change the Becca to Mecca just like that by adding that in. So did that happen? Well, if your city doesn't exist and Petra does, and you want to change the direction of prayer, which all the early Qiblas indicate that the direction of prayer was towards Petra, then that's all you have to do to it. But the problem is that when you redact a history onto an event or events, you get caught. And in this case, they are getting caught because they didn't redact the Qiblas back on the history where Petra is supposed, or Petra was moved from Petra down to Mecca. They didn't, you can't redact archaeological evidence like that. Let's see. So today what we're going to do is we're going to be looking at coins, and we're going to be looking at, I was just preparing. I'm getting old. I'm forgetting stuff. We're going to be looking at inscriptions. There we go. Inscriptions. Good night, man. With Spanish subtitles, I'm a champ. Thank you. I'll cut them in short videos, yes, because I can be long. Thank you for doing that. I appreciate that. Okay. What else do I have here? Did I have anything? Okay, let's talk about coins. Coins. See, I don't have any coins here. Hold on just a second. Let me get a coin. Wait a minute. Okay. I have this little jar here that I keep change in. Okay, so I got a coin here. Let's see. This is a quarter. See that? It's a quarter. Can you see? You can see. You can't. It's blurry. Okay, so it says on the top of it, United States of America. And it says Liberty. And then, oh, it says over here, where is the ACL Sioux? I'm like, it says In God We Trust, for Pete's sake. What's wrong with you people? Putting that on a coin. And then it tells its value. It's a quarter dollar. And then the year it was minted, 2013. And on the back here, it has, this is, let's see, South Dakota and Mount Rushmore. E Pluribus Unum. So it says all these things on this coin. So a coin minted by the United States, used for distribution as currency for our country, authorized by Congress when they created, created the ability to use currency. Now, I'm not sure if we were able to print money under the Articles of Confederation. I can't remember. We have to have had that authority to have a common currency, I would think. But anyway, if you're going to have a country, you have to have a common currency, period. If you don't, you end up like Panama. You know what they use in Panama, Paul? You have any idea?
No.
They use dollars.
Oh, U.S. dollars, yes.
I'm U.S. sorry. Dollars, yeah. They use U.S. dollars. They don't.
I should know that one.
Well, they don't. Well, what was amazing when I got down there, I was thinking, oh, well, what do we got down here?
Oh, they've been using our currency. Now they might be using China's currency, because they bought the canal.
Yeah, they bought the leases. Yeah. You're right. You might as well just bought the canal. You're right. I mean, they bought the leases for the Atlantic side and the Pacific side for the.
So think about that. China controls your ability to go from one side of the continent to the other. That's pretty drastic. And
well, I don't believe that they have charge. They're not in charge of the locks, who goes in and out of the locks. I don't think they have the ability to, but we're getting off topic. Okay. So the point I'm trying to make is that if you want to be a sovereign nation, you have to be able to coin your own currency. And so nothing was different during the 7th and 8th century. If you want to assert yourself as a ruler, you have to have a common currency. And this is what we find with the United States. We had to have a currency. We had to have that currency backed up by the full faith credit of the United States, or at that time, at least it was the gold standard that we were on. And here you have to have some type of legitimacy if you're going to make coins in the 7th or 8th century. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at some of these coins that were minted during the 7th and 8th century and show how the coins that were minted at the time clearly demonstrate that there's a progression in the development of this character, Muhammad, and Islam itself, And more importantly, this is the point that we're gonna circle back on. I think I'm like that Jen Psaki on whatever Biden's press secretary name. We're going to circle back and we're going to see how the coins demonstrate that that Mecca did not exist at that time. Okay, so let's go ahead and take a look at what we're doing here. Okay, so why are coins so important? The caliphs up to Muawiyah. Muawiyah became caliph in 661. You had four caliphs. You had Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, and Ali. So the caliphs up to Muawiyah controlled from Libya all the way to Afghanistan. They had conquered huge swaths of land. So you would have had to been like the second superpower of the day. You had the, you didn't have the Byzantine Empire. Was it the Byzantine Empire that was in control at that time? I believe it was the Byzantine Empire. I'm willing to be wrong. I can't, for some reason, it's not. I'm having a hard time these days. Okay. Connie, your audio was just.
It's a garble mess.
Oh my goodness. It was painful listening to this. Okay, hold on. Try saying something now. Yeah, you're still bad. It's still bad. Still bad. Connie, it's still bad. Okay, so there we go. All right, she's going to come out, come back in. I don't know if she uses a Chromebook or what.
I think she's probably on her phone.
Okay, well, that might be it. Okay, so here you have Muawiyah, all the way up to Muawiyah. They would have controlled the mints under their jurisdiction. Now, remember, Muawiyah came from, I think it wasn't Libya. It was around Lebanon, if I'm not mistaken. And he was completely out of the line of caliphs. I mean, he was like this outsider that comes in and all of a sudden, well, I'm caliph. And then he whacks one of Muhammad's grandsons. I can't remember exactly how that whole story goes, but it's just weird history. Okay, so since they control the mints, they would have been able to mint their own coins easily. And when we look at some of the best evidence to recreate a history of your people or your culture, or in this case, a place, you would expect to find it on a phone. Not on a phone, on a coin.
To see it on a coin, but and you know, it says something. Maybe they weren't intelligent enough to stamp a coin. Maybe there's no people with those kind of smarts. I don't know.
Well, if you can make a sword, you can make a coin. Yeah, Greg, go ahead.
Well, they believe that some dude named Muhammad rode on a imaginary donkey to the temple in Jerusalem, and then ascended into heaven and pushed down the rocks because the rocks wanted to heaven with him. So you're talking about these people? Yeah, okay. I'm going with they couldn't figure out how to stand.
I thought he never made it to heaven. He was sleeping in his wife and went to Mecca in a dream on
how do you, Paul, Barack. Paul, how do you know that? Were you there?
Right.
Well, you know what? Aisha was there and she said he was sleeping.
So you can't trust her. That's a weak hadith. That's naif.
But no, they have proof. No, they have proof because when the Barack was coming back, it laid a terrible noise and a camel died in the desert.
Come on.
Yeah. Okay. If you guys listen,
we're talking about these people. Wait, we're talking about these people. Right. I'm going with option A. They didn't know how to strike the coin.
Okay. Well, I would think that they wouldn't. Somebody would be able to figure this out. I would hope in an entire empire, your world's second largest, according to Jay Smith's slides here, like a superpower. Yeah, I would hope somebody would know how to mint coins.
Well, and the thing is that people were the people that they took over. So that says something else there too.
Yeah, they bribed the Christians to make the coins.
Well, I'm trying to think if you're going to conquer a land, and this is what they did for the first well, okay, so Ali dies, what, 661? Is that, am I right on that? 663, somewhere around there, Ali dies. So
he didn't die. He was murdered by fellow Muslims. So let's get that.
Okay, this is true. Okay, so Ali is murdered in 661. So this is 30 years after Muhammad has expired. And you have this world power going out and conquering people through the sword. I would hope, I would think, I would pray that somebody that is along with them knows how to work with metal. They have to. You have to be able to repair shields, produce swords. You have to have somebody that can do that. So I would think that somebody would know how to mint this. But we don't get this first instance. Here we go. Here's first caliph up to Muawiyah in 661. There it is, right there in front of my nose. 661 was the year that he became caliph. So you would think that somebody up to that point would have minted a coin. But the fact is we do not have anything up to that time period. Okay, so why coins are used to announce new rulers? Okay, the Lydians around 600 BC did this. They said, okay, this is that we are the world superpower now, or we are the power in this region. So we have the authority bestowed upon ourselves because of the power that we have that rests in our army. We can mint our own coins. And that's what they did. And let's face it, coins can be used for more than just commerce. I just showed you, Connie's back. I just showed you a coin, that quarter, where'd it go? Did I put it? I must have put it away. But it had South Dakota on the back. So it tells a story about the state of South Dakota. It had a picture of Mount Rushmore on there. Did you know that the four presidents on Mount Rushmore all owned slaves too? Were you aware of that?
No way.
You listen to Kenny, right? And you actually believe that that man's a scholar.
I need to stop with that. I really do, because I was dinging on him about what I was just talking about before. Were you there? Type thing. I really need to. Connie, do a sound check for us.
He's the one who puts himself out there.
Check, testing, 1, 2, 3.
Testing. That is like 100% better.
Yeah, I noticed when I first came on, I did the test, and it wasn't sounding very good, and so I pulled it up, and the green light was doing okay, but this time it was doing really good. Did you get your answer on the Byzantine period? Because I can give it to you if nobody posted it.
Go ahead.
It started the AD 330 and then went to like 450 AD.
No, Byzantine, okay. So I'm trying to think of who was, because the Roman Empire itself. So we're talking the Eastern Roman. I've taught this stuff before, and I can't. I don't even want to talk about it tonight.
What are you trying to find out?
I'm trying to figure out, because I know it was the Byzantine Empire and the Persian Empire were the world powers prior to, well, the regional powers anyway. You weren't getting over into China or up in where the Eskimos are, or over in Africa yet. But they were the predominant powers in that region at that time. And they had weakened themselves because of a series of wars, just as the time that Muhammad had died. So what that did, is that enabled the Arabs to come out of Arabia and storm into Persia and push north up into the Byzantine Empire and take over all of what was North Africa, push up into Spain and get all the way up into France. Get all the way up into France by 732, within 100 years of the death of Muhammad. So I'm fairly certain it was the Byzantine Empire, but it's really not important based on what we're talking about here. We're talking about the coinage and how coins were used to demonstrate the validity of your power. You can mint coins. Why? Because you have the power to mint coins, and these coins are going to be used in commerce based on people's confidence in your ability to maintain peace and control, where you can trade openly with other people. That's what they're used for. So coins can also be used more than just for commerce. And that's the point that I was leading to, because we have pictures of coins with all kinds of things on them. I'm pushing the wrong buttons here. Okay, so they can identify who the ruler is. Because if you remember back then, they didn't have this mass communications that we have today. They did not have, of course, the internet. They didn't have TV. They didn't have newspapers or anything of the like. So if you were going to proliferate a message, make an announcement, one of the easiest ways to do is just put your picture on a coin, minted on a coin, say, this is our leader right here. And we're using this coin because we have the full faith and confidence in this person to rule. Let's see. So they had to use these as when new rulers came into power too, because just when one ruler dies, it isn't like this huge announcement. Ah, they were to say, Joey's dead. Let's get a new ruler. So they would say, okay, well, Joey's dead. Now here's Radical. He's now in charge. So they put Radical's picture on a coin. So you have coins bearing the image of the ruler. You have.
Now that would be awesome. That would be one awesome coin.
You're going to catch on to that.
That would be awesome.
The radical.
We should do that. There we go. We should make a limited edition radical moderate coin. We should do
that. Yeah, we're going to use your icon there on your picture with that. What is that, like a skull and bone? Let's take a look at that. Hold on. Let me see that. People see that. Yeah, a guy riding a motorcycle that's a skeleton. Yep, that's going to be on the coin. I'm putting it on there. Okay, so it also, to announce a religion, and they also put dates on here. We know, as a matter of fact, we know when Paul was in, I think it was Corinth, because of a coin that bears the image of a ruler that we know that was in Corinth at that time. I might be wrong on the city, but I'm fairly certain I'm not. But we know that this was we can demonstrate things in the Bible based on coins that we found, and you can do that same thing here. They also referred to where these coins were made, where they were minted at. And then you can follow their origins, and if you can follow their origins, you can also follow the chronology in which they were minted and by whom they were minted. Okay, so now I have a hard time pronouncing this word. So let me just do it one more time, because sometimes when you pronounce a word, what is that? Numismatis?
Numismatics. Something like that. Yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, but I want to make sure I pronounce it right. Let's see. Numismatists. Okay.
I used to be a coin collector too many years ago as a kid.
is that how you pronounce it then? You know that for a sure fact?
Well, no. That's like I said, I was a kid.
All right, let's see here. Does this happen? Okay,
it doesn't. Or even I was a teen.
Okay, here we go. Hold on.
Numismatist.
Numismatist. There we go.
Yeah,
There we go.
Yeah, it's the I. There is an I there, yeah.
Numismatist. Thank you. What was that? Was that that's the dictionary.com. There we go. Numismatists. Okay. Numismatists are the ones that study the coins. The problem is numismatists don't really study the history in which the coins were developed, or the history surrounding the coins. So here we need to take a closer look at what they're doing here. Okay. So the people who do this research when they're looking at these coins are great numismatists. Nobody questions that. But they're not good at doing 7th century history. What is everybody dropping off tonight? Holy cow. Anyway, they look at the coins.
We got YouTube. What happens is YouTube is causing difficulties with conservatives talking to each other or Christians talking to each other. So I've been noticing that more and more, especially with fascist book too. So yeah.
What are they doing? I didn't understand.
Well, they'll drop connections. They'll like all of a sudden they'll say you're not friends anymore. Really? So I'm having that difficulty right now. I mean, I've been receiving notices from friends. Hey, did you drop me as a friend? Like, Nope. Yeah.
Hmm. Well, I've noticed I've lost a couple subscribers.
That's probably 100% Google.
Yeah, because I was right at hitting 600 a couple days ago, and now I don't know, 588 or whatever. Which I, you know,
they do that a lot. Unfortunately, you can't trust Google. That's the same thing with most of the social media. They like to play with your numbers.
Well, I'm not. Anyway. Let's stay on topic here. Okay, so they look at the coins and they describe them correctly. That's the job of the numismatist. But when you try to impose a 9th and 10th century traditional narrative, which we get from Islam, it doesn't work. And I'm going to show you why it doesn't work. When you try to impose this narrative onto these coins, even a numismatist will be able to tell there's a problem. But the reason why they do this is because, well, let's just take a break here. Let's just discuss this real quick. If you work in any element of academia today, whether you are a college professor, whether you work for an archaeological department at a college or a business for that matter, or you're a teacher, and you come out and you question the Islamic narrative and say in a classroom or in a professional setting, Mecca didn't exist in the 7th century. What's going to happen to your career?
Well, depends on how you go about that. I think it would depend. I mean, just say you could make a question saying, I'd love for someone to give me evidence.
But if you begin... If you begin a premise, let's, for example, you're looking at a coin and you want to make some type of hypothesis about when this coin existed, and you're using the standard Islamic narrative, but yet you've watched Cross and the Crescent and you've seen that Mecca simply did not exist in the 7th century, and the Qiblas that we do have, that we have unearthed, and the archaeological evidence that we have outside of Islamic sources shows that it is not Mecca. Are you still free to make that academic assertion about?
Depends on how lacking in the concept of scholarship your supervisors are.
Okay. Well, I'm just, I would.
That's my best way to put it. Okay. I will say that, yeah, you are in oppression in that respect. You're not allowed the freedom of academic scholarship, which they claim. Once you start using that.
Yes, you do not have the ability to have free inquiry when it's about certain subjects. Yeah. For an example, if you were to say that, okay, well, the North African slave trade across the Mediterranean into Europe went on for 10 centuries, and you tried to make that statement in a public university today, even though it's true, it's a taboo thing to talk about how North Africans enslaved Europeans. The only thing that they want you to talk about is the transatlantic slave trade. They don't want to talk to you about the Arab slave trade, nor do they want you to talk about the North African slave trade. It's always about the transatlantic. So when you start talking about that, then you're going to be labeled, and then people are going to start questioning your academic credentials. And when that happens, well, when it comes time to, if you're not tenured, guess what? Somebody takes a walk. And what I'm saying is about these numismatists and making assertions about certain coins, beginning with the premise that the standard Islamic narrative is not true, is not proven, they can get themselves into some academic trouble. Based on that alone,
based on supposition and not on, and that's the issue. You get in trouble based on a lack of evidence, and that's where people are afraid to stand up and say what we're saying here. You have to, if you can provide evidence, I'll accept it. That's all we're saying. Provide evidence.
But you're not making an assertion, though. You're asking for evidence to demonstrate something.
That's it's a game. I will say this. If you're in the education field, you have to play it like a game. Ask for the evidence.
I 100% agree with that. It can be a game. We won't go into the details, but yeah, it can be a big game. Okay, let's jump back over to what we were talking about. Okay, so they have no choice because that's all they know. They haven't been taught a different narrative. The only thing they've been taught is that, okay, Muhammad was born in 572. He died in 632. He had his ministry from 610 all the way up to 632. And then Abu Bakr was the caliph. So they're given this narrative, the standard Islamic narrative, and you cannot deviate from that because if you do, well, then you're off the reservation and you have to start demonstrating other things other than just taking the evidence that's in front of you and making applications as to where and when it originated without having it conform with the standard Islamic narrative. And that you're going to see here in a second exactly what I'm talking about. I know I'm kind of talking in circles and you're like, would you hurry up and get to the point? Okay, let me get there. Okay, because there's only one narrative. There isn't any other narrative. Mecca existed in the 7th century. Mecca was an ancient town, according to the standing Islamic narrative. And to get away from that is to get off the academic reservation. Okay, so why not just get rid of these traditions that started in the 7th century? Because this is what historians are supposed to do. But here's what they lament. There just doesn't seem to be any coins from the Hejaz. Whoops. The Hejaz. Does anybody know what the Hejaz is? The Hejaz.
Oh, you better tell us.
Okay, the Hejaz is that region that includes Mecca and Medina. That proximity between those two cities. Those are the two holiest cities in all of Islam. And I'm not sure if I know non-Muslims are not allowed in Mecca. But I'm not sure if they're allowed in Medina or not.
Allowed in Medina. They're technically not allowed anywhere in Saudi Arabia. But unfortunately, when they discovered the oil, they didn't have a lot of, Muslims that could, knew how to extract oil.
They hire a lot of Filipinos into Saudi Arabia.
I would also submit that I spent a couple months in Saudi Arabia myself, albeit it wasn't in the Hejaz, it was further up north, but you're right. I mean, they've made compromises, big compromises.
Oh, admit it, you were there in Mecca. You helped reinstall the Black Rock,
I have pictures.
Were you in the military, Eric?
Yeah, I was in the Army for 21 years. Yeah.
At that time.
Yeah, I haven't. For the invasion, when we went into Iraq in 2003, the staging area was in northern Saudi Arabia. We flew into, I think it was Arifjan, I think is where we flew into. And then we got on buses and were bussed out in the middle of the desert to nowhere, and I was on a couple camps out there, Pennsylvania, New York, Udari, and then we went north into wait a second, I wasn't in Saudi Arabia, I was in Kuwait.
That sounds a lot better.
Yeah, okay, yeah. That makes better. I wasn't in Saudi Arabia, I'm sorry, I was in Kuwait. What the heck? Okay. Sorry, it just didn't sound. I was there. Wait a second.
Dude, no, you need to take some oil or something for your mind.
I'm really disappointed. I'm having a hard day today, guys. I'm sorry. I don't know what the problem.
I'm really disappointed.
Weekend. It was a long weekend, so we'll give you some slack, Eric.
Well, yeah, and I'm out of my mojo because when I've noticed, I've been doing this for I don't know how many years now. And if I don't do a show on Sunday or if I don't do a show on Tuesday, I'm just like, wow, what's going on here? I'm out of kilter.
Eric, I'm very disappointed. Are you telling me? Because I was going to do a whole bit now on how you left your Koofer crap in all his old money. And now you're telling me you weren't even there? Not only were you not even there, but you were in the Army, a master sergeant. You're telling me you didn't even know where you were at? That's
and you know,
there was a video.
My guy, there was a video that came out. I think it was this morning or yesterday morning. And I'm not going to be dogmatic about this because I can't remember. Obviously, I can't remember crap right now. Anyway, where a reporter, a TV reporter, was on the air and she was having a stroke. And she,
really?
Was, oh yeah, and she was. It was just. It's just frightening to see people have that cognitive decline right there in front of your eyes.
Sure.
Right here. it's scary.
This is today. This is today.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, I think it was today.
This is today.
I think it was today. Good night. Why are you holding me up? Why? Quit pressuring me. I had it on my Kaffir phone. What did I do with my phone?
Oh my god. I'm gonna have to look that up. That's shocking.
Yeah, I go. I read Revolver and the Liberty Daily. So it was linked on one of those news sites.
You have to share that link. That's interesting. No, because I got to pay attention because, you know, I swear my mom is having a stroke every other day.
Yeah, it's some frightening stuff to see. And they had, there was a senator or a congressman a couple years ago that had.
That was,
he was given a speech.
Yeah, you know who that was? That was what, Nadler, Jerry Nadler. Yeah. Which. Unfortunately, he survived. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's get back to. Golly. Okay. So. All right. Let's keep going here. Okay. So let's look at some of the claims here. Here you have. Where the mints are situated in relation to Mecca and Medina. So you see Mecca and Medina here. Let me make this bigger so people can see it more clearly. Okay, so you have Mecca right here. Here's Mecca. Here's Medina. This region here is called the Hejaz. Now, look where these coins come from. Let's get back over here. Here we go. Now, when you look at the Western mints, they're in Syria, Lebanon, and Israel. Now look how far north that is. So when we find coins that mention Muhammad or mention anything about Islam, they're all way far north. Now look at where the Eastern mints are. You see where those are. Okay, so all those areas are where we find coins that bear the name of Muhammad. And Islam. Whoops. What did I just do? Sorry. Let me get back in here. Okay, so they're all over here in the eastern part of the empire. Now, what does this tell us? Well, all of the mints would have been, and now if you think about this, if they were under Muslim leaders, under the caliphs, they would have been down here in Mecca and Medina. But they're clear up here and clear over here. Why is that? Well, the power base is up here in the north and in the east. So the conclusion is none of these mints were in the Hejaz. They're both too far north and too far east, and this confronts that traditional standard Islamic narrative. Because if they were, in fact, coins minted for this empire, which is supposed to be centrally located in Mecca and Medina, why don't we find any coins minted from those regions? Why don't we have any coins mentioning that, that's where they were minted? And the fact is we don't. And if we don't have any coins, we don't have any tradition there to support Mecca or Medina as any type of important, have any importance for Islam itself. This is the problem that Muslims do not want to discuss. They would rather discuss why we celebrate Christmas on December 25th, or why we, you know, all the other things that they always want to discuss. Boring. Okay. What should we do now? Let's look at the coins. What should we do now? Here we go. Since the Islamic traditions assume that There was a well-established Muslim empire at the time of Muhammad's demise, since they also assumed that during the reign of the rightly guided Caliph, 624 to 661, that the empire expanded across Tripoli to Western Afghanistan, which it did. There should be some evidence in that huge swath of land on the coins. Because, like we said, if you were going to establish yourself as a ruler, demonstrate that you have power, you're going to put your face on a coin. We do not have anything there because there should be coins which were minted by the caliphs with their name. So we don't have anything with Ali. We don't have anything with Uthman. We don't have anything with Umar, and we don't have anything with Abu Bakr on it, period. So what do we do find? Oops. Coins tell a story. The numismatists tell us Muhammad dies, or let's see here. Muhammad dies, but no Islamic coins exist during his time, which you really wouldn't expect to find that. But you would expect to find something after he died during that Rushdidun time period. But then you have the Sassanid. These Arab coins are Christian in the West and Zoroastrian in the East up to 661, and all the coins are minted too far north. Then you have Muawiyah, the first caliph of the Umayyad Empire, minting coins with Christian crosses on them. Isn't that interesting? These coins have Christian crosses on them with Zoroastrian fire altars, and this is 6680 AD. And then you have Abd al-Malik, who is the one that is responsible for building the Dome of the Rock. This is, this may be a first century coin. They're not entirely sure, but it includes the Shahadat on it. And it's widely used throughout the empire and actually caused a war, which is a different story. And coins, mints a coin with his image and a sword that he is the servant of Allah. So Abd al-Malik demonstrates his power and basic tenets of Islam finally 60 years after the death of Muhammad. So let's do an overview of this. Go ahead. What was the question?
Do you personally, as a historian, take Robert Spencer's kind of mythicist sort of position? Because that's what he seems to kind of promote, is that a lot of this historical narrative is actually more of a myth than it is actual fact, because it seems
about
like
Muhammad.
Yeah. About in the caliphs and pretty much the Islamic history. Do you think it's more of like a mythicized position? Is that the position you would take?
I do 100%. Thank you.
Thank you, Connie. I appreciate it. Always a weird opinion. I would be more cautious about it, because this is a difference of doing it from a personal perspective. I think personally, yeah, I think that the historicity of Islam itself, the historicity of Muhammad, does not pan out. It doesn't work. I mean, there's so many contradictory things in there, and I think that it's clearly a lot of this history has been redacted back upon what has become the narrative. But if I was going to do it professionally, I would probably give the opinion that I do not have a lot of confidence that it is all entirely true. Now, was there a man named Muhammad? I would say probably some character that existed in the 7th century did exist, yes. But
in the north.
What's that?
Yeah, in the north by Iran, Pakistan, Iraq.
And I would say that he definitely didn't come from Mecca, because Mecca did not exist at that time. That has been redacted. That's clearly been redacted upon the entire narrative because of the absolute absence. I mean, zero evidence supporting the existence of Mecca at this time. So it appeared, and then when we start talking about the caliphs, again, there may have been period people that were caliphs, but the stories that go along with them, I believe, are redactions. And that's pretty clear that a lot of these stories have been redacted upon the standard narrative. Now, is there some truth to this? Of course, there's always a kernel of truth in everything. But the idea that it's that far south, that I can say with a lot of certitude, Mecca did not exist in the 7th century. There is nothing. When I say nothing, there's nothing. And I'm getting into more evidence here in just a little bit. Do you have any response to that? I'm sorry, Rad. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, speaking just for me, I'm speaking just for me. I don't believe that there was a single individual named Muhammad. Remember, Muhammad is a title. It means the praised one. It was not a proper name. There's no evidence that it was ever a proper name. I believe it's a composite. The stories are composites between various holy men or shamans from Arabia, so on and so forth. I do not believe that there was ever a Mecca. I mean, even in the Quran, what I would describe as Mecca, it makes no sense. There was evidently a Medina, okay, but that significance, historically wise, was insignificant. What had happened here was that you had Arabs in Arabia that had been controlled and been kept in check by the Byzantines and the Persians, okay, for centuries. But these Arabs had outgrown their resources, and they came screaming out of that desert with a vengeance. Now, was there somebody that kind of united them, okay, around this thing of Muhammad? Definitely so. And I would say that's where you're going to find maybe your Abu Bakr's, not Abu Bakr's, I would say Uthman's. No, actually, not even Uthman. It would have been, since it was Abu Bakr, no, then Omar. Probably Omar or Uthman was the central figure. And they just told this tale that was either believable at the time or maybe it was woven around different things. But either way, they came screaming out of the desert because they had no choice. There is actually documented evidence where when they had Casa Syria surrounded, they besieged. We got to understand, Jerusalem was, they didn't want Jerusalem. They pretty much left Jerusalem alone. The major port city, the major control, okay, of the land of Canaan or Palestine or whatever you want to call it, okay, was Casa Syria. Okay, I know I'm mispronouncing that, but when they had besieged it, they besieged it for 3 years, okay. But unfortunately, they didn't have a navy, so they, not that. But anyway, there was a thing between the generals. Okay, at that time, I think it was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, whatever. His name was Khalid. Where the Roman garrison, the Roman general in charge says, hey, look, we're going to pay you a bunch of money just to leave us alone now. Okay, which is what they would normally do. Okay, and Khalid or whoever it was responded like, no, how about this? You go back to eat thorns and thistles. We're not coming back. We're not going back into the desert. In other words, this was their time. They were seizing upon it because Rome and Persia had bled themselves white, and they were able to conquer these lands for probably 50, 60 years before this. Okay? And like I said, this was a momentum. This was a thing that they started, 50, 60 years beforehand, okay, to take these borderline towns and keep them, and the Romans had no interest in going back there. The Persians had no interest in going back there. So, in other words, they just kept going, and they got a momentum. Now, was there somebody that they said was Muhammad, the praised one, that united these tribes in order to do that? I don't know, maybe. But either way, they developed this Quran, they developed these stories, they developed all this stuff later to basically solidify what they were doing. That's what I firmly believe. And when I invent the time travel machine, which I plan on doing here sometime, I'm going to go back in time and I'm going to prove it without a shadow of a doubt.
Okay, when you do that, Rad, can you drop down to Mecca and snap a couple photos for us just to make sure?
I definitely will.
So I want to ask you, Rhett, are you talking about like sort of like a heresy type of character or Hercules, that it's sort of a compilation of multiple characters that get fused into one? Is that
I'm talking about like a Robin Hood character is what I'm thinking. It's kind of this legendary that's going to bear out to kind of tie in some loose ends of the history. But as you get further and further and further and further from the event, the legend grows larger, grows larger, grows larger. And if you're not in a written culture, and you're in a it was almost a completely oral culture at the time, those tales can get off tall. And I
just to respond to you. I would say, with obviously what Eric said, a Robin Hood or a Herculean story, et cetera, et cetera. But either way, was there the central figure before the Arabs came screaming out of the desert? He was a compilation of various shamans, okay? They cobbled together, possibly. But either way, even if there was no Muhammad, the same thing would have happened, okay? Because it was the Arabs' time. Something united these tribes, okay, to come screaming out of the desert. So they put it around this figure. They put it around this. I mean, seriously, think about it. They chose this place called Mecca that even if it existed, nobody would want to go to. You know what I mean? Nobody in their right mind would want to go to this place at all. Okay, especially in that day and age, okay? There was nothing there. So therefore, nobody could go, even if they could, nobody would want to. But even if they could, nobody could verify these stories, which came out later, okay? Well, no, Fred, this whole thing...
Fred, you're so on target, because here's the other thing to that.
Oh, by the way, I got to go to my train, so I'm probably going to lose you guys. All right, let's.
Don't miss your train, Rad.
Well, this is what Rad is so right, and what makes it dangerous even more so. The history that we're being given by Islam is that before Muhammad came along, there was this Kaaba there, and that people were worshiping the Black Stone by going around and migrating there. And this was a money-making industry. So Mecca was a moneymaker because of the amount of people coming. But if Mecca wasn't there, then the polytheists didn't gather, then, so why are people going around that Black Stone? Why is the Kaaba there?
Well, this is where I find it very, very problematic, because we're going to be getting into rock inscriptions here next.
And I have one thing I wanted to ask too. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. One last thing. It was about Abdul Malik. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's a very interesting character. I took a class in graduate school on Jerusalem, so I learned about the history of Jerusalem, and it was pretty brutal about how Rome treated the Israelite people there after the, you know, during the time of the temple being destroyed. But it also talked about Abdul Malik too in the books that I was reading. And the guy, like, what he talked about was like how he had relationships with women and how he objectified women. It was so disgusting and gross. Like, he talked about how what he would do to a Byzantine woman, like, what, you know, physically, if you know what I'm saying. I'm not going to say the word because it's like inappropriate, but you know what I mean? Like, physical interactions with women. I wouldn't even call them romantic, but kind of like nasty. But it basically talked about how he basically listed all these women and what purpose they have. Like, he said, this woman would have babies. This woman he would have physical interactions with. And some said that his breath smelled very bad too. He's a very controversial, strange character. Yet he's kind of heralded as this really amazing person who built the Dome of the Rock. But he's a very bizarre character. I remember reading, I was like in my, I don't know, I was very young at the time, and it was just very bizarre and very kind of shocking to read about him. I'll put the information in the chat too, so you can see it.
Okay. Well, I'm just trying to think how is Abd al-Malik tied to the Roman Empire? I'm not. Are you saying this because...
You're saying in my class. No, my class was covering all of that. So we covered a whole history.
Oh, okay.
So it was, we started up at that point, and we went all the way down.
So you know, you want to talk about somebody that was grotesque, brutal, and evil? Tamerlane. Look up who that guy is. That guy was just... there's a story.
I think
where...
one of the people, the Boston folks, had his name. You know, those Boston people who...
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, one of them was Tamerlane. but Tamerlane, a lot of his exploits were in the East, in India and such. And, you know, some of the, you know, it's just disgusting, some of the stories that you get from that. Okay, let's jump back over to the coins here. Okay, so early coins show a clear Christian history. This is important to understand. The earliest coins from this era show a clear Christian identity on both sides of the coin. You have in the West, you have that cross that's on one of them, and then you have a Zoroastrian fire in the East. The early Islamic coins just don't exist. There's nothing there. If they had been controlled, so if they had controlled so much land, why not mint coins? Why have those mints clear up in the North and clear over in Persia or Persian lands or ex-Persian lands?
Can you open up the screen bigger?
Yeah, let me do that. Sorry. Okay. You have Arab proxy states. They seem to be Christian, and others want to be don't want any religious symbols on their coins. Muawiyah has Christian symbols on his in the West, and over Zoroastrian symbols over in the East. And this is up to 680 AD. This is 50 years after the death of Muhammad. You see, with Muawiyah, you see Allah's name, but that's just the God. But you have no mention of Muhammad for some odd reason, where Muhammad today is elevated to almost being deified himself. Because every time you say his name, oh, you got a peace be unto him. And if you criticize him, well, that's blasphemy for pizza. I mean, it's just sick. Okay, and then in 92 to 93, you have Abd al-Malik. Introduces Muhammad and the Shahada. This is the first Islamic coin that we have. But if you have Muhammad, and Rad mentioned this before, and I think Paul mentioned it, as far as Muhammad being a title, the praised one, it doesn't necessarily have to be a name. And this is the premise, as we were talking earlier, about Robert Spencer's book. He's saying, look, this is a title. It does not have to necessarily be a specific name identifying an individual. It's a title. It's like Messiah. You know, we associate Messiah, of course, with Jesus Christ. However, that's a title. It's not his name, as in where there's a verse in the Quran that actually calls his name is Messiah, Jesus Christ, or Jesus Christ, Messiah, or something on those lines. Anyway, 693 to 696, you have Justinian from the Byzantine Empire attacking Abd al-Malik and adds his image with the Shahada, either to confront or claim Messiahship. And then Arab script, the Shahada with no associates, attacks Jesus' divinity, John 3:16, and the superiority. I don't know why that came up right there. So why Allah's name is introduced, it's Nabataean. Muhammad's is not. And the conclusion is doesn't the numismatic evidence support the archaeological and documented evidence? And it does not. So doesn't this suggest, therefore, that Islam was not introduced by Muhammad, but by Abd al-Malik? And I'm sorry you can't see that. I couldn't manipulate the slide well enough without completely changing things around. But it says these 7th century coins confront the traditional 9th and 10th century Islamic narrative, suggesting Islam was introduced 60 years later. Okay, do we have time for inscriptions?
Yes.
You guys want to do inscriptions?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. let's go ahead and do inscriptions, because they tell a very similar story about what we've been discussing. And I've been able to make the script larger here. So, whoops, wrong one. My fault. Okay, let's go ahead and look at rock inscriptions. Now, these are taken from Yehuda Nevo's book and from Dr. Ahmed Al-Jalad in online interviews that Jay Smith did. Okay, rock inscriptions are one of the best ways to know of a period in history because they are durable and plentiful. If the classical account of Islam
concerning its emergence was true, there should be all kinds of rock inscriptions written prior to the 7th century about Mecca. Now, let me slide off here. And I want to make sure you understand this part here. If the standard Islamic narrative is true, that Mecca predates Islam, so that we're talking 5th, 6th, 4th, 3rd century, all the way back to when Adam and Eve existed, and it was supposed to be the original religion of the pagans of that era, then the pagans themselves would be making pilgrimages to Mecca to worship their gods, these 360 idols that supposedly existed in the Kaaba. When these people would travel to Mecca, you would expect to find some type of inscription of these people celebrating their travels there and their journey to Mecca to worship their god at the Kaaba. This is what you would expect, because we find it all over Israel when they went to Jerusalem. You would find inscriptions in rocks where people would inscribe saying, "We're going to Jerusalem today, have a nice day," or whatever they would inscribe. But you would expect to find that along trade routes going through in and out of there, people celebrating the Kaaba. We don't find diddly squat. Nothing. Nothing is there. It's like the entire desert was one big blank prior to the advent of Islam. And even in the advent of Islam, it's still one big blank for 100 years almost. There's nothing there. Even with Abd al-Malik, what do we have? We have the Dome of the Rock. What about Medina? Do we have something down in Medina that can be demonstrated to predate or exist in the 7th century? That discusses Islam anyway. I'm not doubting that, because we all know Yathrib existed. Medina existed prior to the 7th century. But do we have anything in the 7th century saying that Islam existed? I don't think we do. I might be wrong on that one, but I know I'm not wrong on Mecca. So I want to make sure that we understand that this classical account that we have, this standard Islamic narrative that we have, is blank. Okay, so there should be a lot of written inscriptions on these rocks about Muhammad, Mecca, Islam, Muslims, and the Quran. But according to the Islamic traditions, Muhammad and Islam dominated everything in that era of the world during that time. So we'd expect to
see. Can you open up the screen?
We expect to see something. Sorry, Connie. And then, let's see, let's move. Come on. Why isn't this working? Oops, I'm pushing the wrong button. No wonder. But yet we don't find anything. And this is my point. There's nothing there. There are no rock inscriptions from that area. There's nothing on a map. There's nothing on, you know, discussing the trade route. Now, if you want to date these rock inscriptions, you can see, you know, people were hired to write them down, of course, and put dates on them so that we would know that the date of them. They are dated by the evolution of theological ideas within them and the evolution of the script itself. And none of them date to that period. None of them. There's nothing there. Everything that we have dates after that period. So when we look at the rock inscriptions, where are they? Well, I know you're going to be interested to see this. We have 30,000 rock inscriptions that have been cataloged across Arabia, the Negev, Transjordan, Syria, and possibly another 70,000 that might be from that time period that have yet to be researched. Now, we would expect to find Muhammad's name on the inscriptions along the Hajj routes, but we don't. We find nothing with Muhammad's name on it until 690 AD. That is very problematic, because if Muhammad was indeed a prophet, you would think under Abu Bakr, you would think under Umar, you would think under Uthman, and even Ali, you would expect to find somebody making Hajj to Mecca saying that I'm on my way to Mecca because Muhammad's the prophet of Islam. You would expect somebody to write something noticeable, but there's nothing there. Now, south of Medina, you have a Sabaic script that originates in Yemen that was created around 600 BC. And that this script continues for another
was it say, for 1,200 years, yet all of this contained on the needed vowels and consonants required for a religious text, unlike the 7th century Arabic. And note, too, the Arabic script we find on these inscriptions are Nabataean Aramaic, which are only found in the north and are similar to the Quranic text. So if we're going to, and this is the interesting part here, folks, read this note too again. The Arabic script we find on these inscriptions are Nabataean. Nabataeans were traders. These guys were very proficient in establishing huge trade routes. They were known throughout the world at that time. And they are only found, these inscriptions are only found in the north. And the text or the script that they're found in is very similar to what we find in the Quran. That is problematic because that then suggests, doesn't clearly demonstrate, but suggests that the Quran is created up here instead of down here where it's supposed to be. So right. if we're using these inscriptions, this is what we find. I'm sorry, I'm off. I let somebody in and it booted me back down. Okay, so the rock inscriptions themselves clearly do not demonstrate the existence of Mecca, but yet they turn around and disprove a lot of these claims that that are being made by Muslims today. So if we look at Lindstedt's rock inscriptions, and he is an author.
I've got a question.
Yep.
About the rock. Okay. Then that means at that time, all those time periods that you were just showing, there wasn't even a sign that the Kaaba rocks even existed at that time at the Kaaba. Right?
Well, I'm
rock
trying
inscriptions.
To,
I mean, rock, at rock, least rocks.
There's no evidence that there was a Hajj.
Hajj to Mecca. Okay, it demonstrates that there wasn't a Hajj going to Mecca. It doesn't demonstrate that there wasn't any rock someplace else.
I'm just talking about the two rocks at Kaaba. Don't you think that they would have said, hey, these two rocks don't have inscriptions, but they're, you know, noteworthy. They're on the Kaaba, yada, 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 and they don't have it, right? You would think that they would have put it there if it existed. In those dates.
Put it where, Connie? I'm not following.
In the list. Go back to your list.
Okay.
Right? Because we're talking about rocks, but I know we're talking about rock inscriptions. But don't you think if it was pretty important, you got like dates of 690 AD. 690 AD, let's go.
Okay.
You know, you would think that if this Kaaba rock and the Yemeni rock existed on the Kaaba, that it might have been on the list, on this list, saying, hey, it doesn't have any inscriptions, but it's pretty important to these people, and they don't have it there. It's not on the list.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. the point I was making. There's nothing,
okay.
there are no inscriptions on rocks following these routes into Mecca that predate 632, the 7th century. Let's just go even the 7th century. There's nothing there that predates the 7th century indicating that Mecca was a place on a map where people had migrated to for religious purposes, whether it was for the Hajj or whether it was for pagan purposes. There's nothing where people wrote on rocks saying, hey, I'm going to Mecca or I'm going to Makaroba or whatever the heck. There's nothing there. And that's problematic. It's not necessarily writing on the rocks that are on the Kaaba. I'm talking about
on
stones on the way to the Kaaba. There's nothing there. Is that what you're asking?
Well, I was just saying that, you know, all these archaeologists, you know, if the rock had big significance, even though it didn't have any inscriptions on it, you would think that it would be in history somewhere saying, hey, these two rocks are real special to the Islamic people. And it's not there. It's not in history.
Well, and that's the point. I mean, that's the point.
That's
exactly.
The point
There's nothing
yes,
there.
There's nothing there because they would have said something, right? Okay, these two rocks don't have an inscription, but it's real important to these people. So we're going to add it in here. We know it exists, and here's the list. Here's the date that we found it. You know, they could have talked to the people and said, how long have you had it? And then talking to, you know, the elders, how long have you known that it existed? There's nothing there. Nothing.
Right. There's right. There, yeah. There's no evidence.
Jeez, people, this. Come period. To Christ, please, Muslims. Yeah.
Amen. Yeah. Amen. Okay. Let's jump back to this. But you're absolutely right. If Mecca did exist, we would expect to find something. And if it was this important city, like this mother of all cities I just described, we would expect not only to find something, we would expect to find a lot of things.
Oh yes,
supporting its existence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you would have heard maybe heard the prophets speak about it, Jesus speak about it, Paul speak about it.
Well, this is where we got in. I got into. I don't know if it was on this show or if it was on Clubhouse. We were discussing one of the Psalms where it mentions the Valley of Weeping, the Valley of Becca. And how they were trying to use that, say that was Mecca, but the problem with the verse,
they're so desperate.
I know, and this is how desperate they were. The problem with the verse is it says it has pools of water in it.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been to Mecca? Is there any pools of water in Mecca? No, there's nothing there.
Wait, have you ever been to Mecca? How do you know
there's
not water?
Right. Yeah.
Hey, Google Earth is a good thing. Google Earth, they even have a gin mosque.
Wait, right now in Mecca, there are pools of water. See, that was a prophecy.
I don't think so.
Yeah, the hotels have pools. That's gotta be it. There it is.
Very good, Steve.
That's funny. Okay, so let's soldier on here. Okay, so let's look at the 100 dated rock inscriptions that we do have. Okay, so this guy in Lindstedt, he looked at 100 rock inscriptions from 640 to 740 AD. Okay, 640 to 740 AD. And I think this is book Who's In and Who's Out, Early Muslim Identity Through Epigraphy and Theory. So prior to 690, there are no evidence of anything Islamic on any of the inscriptions. Prior to 690, look at that date, folks. That's 60 years after the death of Muhammad. Now, if you formulate everything, comes except for the formula anyway, everything comes after 690. So you have the pre-formula of the standard Islamic narrative, but there's nothing there physically. 690 to 710, you finally have Prophet Muhammad appearing on an inscription. 710 to 720, you have the Muslim rites appear, you have a pilgrimage, a prayer, a fasting, and then 720 to 30, you have the names Muslim and Islam referred to a special group contradistinction, there we go, to Christianity. So the conclusion is that it was only in 730, 100 years after Muhammad's death and onwards, that there's evidence of a popular devotion to Muhammad himself as a prophet or a messenger. And the emerging model of Islam, as we know it, which makes the Islamic traditions incredibly awkward, since they insist this would have been completely formed by 632. Furthermore, since there is 100 years of silence, we know that it in the rock inscriptions prior to 730, this would indicate that Islam did not exist as a distinct religion until long after the time of Muhammad, which cast doubt on whether he had any part in Islam's origin. So if we're looking at the standard Islamic narrative, things that we know that happened, Dome of the Rocks built in 690. You have the sacking of Jerusalem in 638 and the Pact of Omar signed, allegedly. And then you have the burning of the library in Alexandria, Egypt. These are pretty hard dates, but the people who did these, we have no idea for sure who did them. We have the Pact of Umar, which was allegedly written in 638 and then imposed upon everybody else when they went around conquering people. But we don't know for sure if it was from somebody called Umar. This may, again, be something that's been redacted back on the standard Islamic narrative. Who'd we lose here? Did we lose? We lost Paul. Where'd Paul go? Anyway, all right, let's go back to this slide here. I think we have one. Let's see. I tell you what, we're going to stop right there.
Man.
Florida. Sorry.
24 only.
I have
an hour
and
24 minutes.
I haven't. Would you give me a, cut me some slack here. I haven't gone through this enough because, like I said, I was gone all weekend. And when I got home this afternoon, I just kind of went through the slides and watched a couple of the videos that Jay had and read some of the notes that I'd taken when I did this class, trying to get as much information out there as I possibly can. So I want to do this right. So we'll do part five next week. When it looks like we might even have up to maybe 8 or 9 parts for this, which is fine. We can come back at some point.
Yes,
in time
this
in the
is interesting.
And go through all this, but the bottom line, and here's why we're doing this, is number one, you have a religion here that denies the deity of Christ, denies the very thing that saves your soul from eternity in hell. That's why we do this show, is because we want to show Muslims, and we want to show these Dawagandists how wrong they are when they try to talk about the superiority of Islam over Christianity, whether that's theologically.
Pride.
Exactly. That's exactly mm-hmm. what it is. We do it theologically, or if we do it with archaeological evidence, or if we do it with manuscript, whatever type of evidence is. And we're showing that the historicity of your belief system is blank. There's nothing there. This has all been a fabrication, and that you are worshiping, based on what we've shown you previously in other shows, a God and whose prophet is probably what is David Wood says, the most demonstrably false prophet in history. And instead of talking about Muhammad, we want to talk about the history here, because we all know how that offensive that is to talk about Muhammad. But the guy that you think that existed there, it looks more and more like it's all made up. And I think the evidence that we're presenting here each Tuesday leads to that. Okay, does anybody have anything they want to add for the team? Anybody? Anybody?
Read that scripture, because go ahead.
I was just going to say, let's go, Brandon. And don't forget to play the closing. And Issa, stick yes. around, dude. I want to talk to you.
Issa what?
Issa, stick around and for sure I want to talk to you.
Okay, yeah. Issa, don't go nowhere when we sign off. All right, Connie, did you have anything that you want to add? Go
yeah,
ahead.
If you can read, because I can't. If that this StreamYard, if I just try to, hang on, run. Okay, is it too loud on my side?
No, you're fine. Go ahead.
Okay, good. Yeah, every time I try to go to my Bible app or go online while I'm here and I go off this screen and I come back, it takes off my sound. That's why I've been having to come back on and off and on and off and on and off. But if you'll read John 8, where Jesus talks about when the devil speaks a lie, he speaks of his own character because there's no truth in him. That so reminds me of also Islam. There's no truth there, so they lie because they're not, you know, they're just.
So this is Jesus speaking to the Sadducees.
To the Jews. Yeah. If you'll just pat, not the first part, you're of your father, the devil.
Yeah.
But just when he talks about, you know, he was a liar from the murderer
Jesus
from the beginning.
Lie, yeah. I tell you, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. Now it's a sin. Slave has no permanent place in the family, but belongs to it forever. So if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed.
I keep on reading.
I'm going.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Some context here.
Oh, I thought you were going to end it going, oh, no.
I know that you are Abraham's descendants, yet you are looking for a way to kill me because you have no room for my word. I am telling you whatever I've seen in the Father's presence. you are doing what you have heard from your father. Abraham is our father, they answered. If you were Abraham's children, said Jesus, then you would do what Abraham did. As it is, you are looking for a way to kill me, a man who has told you the truth. I heard from God. Abraham did not do such things. You are doing the works of your own father. We are not illegitimate children, they protested. The only father we have is God himself. Jesus said to them, if God were your father, you would love me, for I have come here from God. I have not come on my own. God sent me. Why is my language not clear to you? Because you are unable to hear what I say. You belong to your father, the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth, for there's no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and the father of lies.
I like that other it's in the Greek, the translation. He speaks his own character. When he lies, he speaks his own character.
Right.
Meaning when he lies, that's who he is. But my attack is against Satan. And he's our wrestle. And so it just, Islam just matches so much of that, because it's so hidden, so lies, not loving the truth of murder, and wants to do murder.
Well, it goes on to say
in that verse.
Yep. It goes on to say in that verse, in verse 58, where he says, he says, I am. He said,
before Abraham was
created,
I am. Then they picked up stones to kill him. They knew exactly what he was saying. He was saying he was the great I am, ego emi.
Quit making
sense.
They
knew it.
Show me where Jesus says, where does Jesus say, I am God, worship me?
He just said it right there. I am God. And what do? You worship God alone.
Amen.
He just said it. That's their answer.
Okay. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Thank you, everybody that was on the panel, for participating tonight. We'll be back with parts.
We're closed.
Five.
We're closed.
I'm going to close. Cut me some slack, dude. I'm a professional. I almost forgot. You're right. Okay, here we go. God bless you. We'll see you Sunday on the Cross and the Crescent discussion.
Advanced student and specialist, that the standard narrative has holes. That's what I'm talking about.
That's all, folks.